Gary Burnson was our top guy in the fight against terrorism in Afghanistan and that part of the world for several years. He spent 23 years as an undercover operations officer for the Central Intelligence Agency, was awarded the Intelligence Star, one of their top awards, a couple of years ago for his work in Afghanistan in 2000 and 2001. He was the guy who was essentially our number one field commander in the hunt for Osama bin Laden and against al-Qaeda. He has written about many of those experiences in a new book called Jawbreaker. On the front cover of the book, it's got a little sticker that says, "The book the CIA doesn't want you to read." Well, I have read it and invited Gary to come on the show today and talk about the book and his adventures. Gary, welcome to the Paul Harris Show.
Pleasure to be with you today, Paul.
How hard was it to get this by the CIA?
Well, there was a problem, and the CIA, all CIA officers sign an agreement that they'll get their books cleared by CIA, and I'm a loyal officer, and I care about the mission. Under law, and previous cases, there was a case about 20 years ago, the Marchetti case with a book called The Cult of Intelligence. A federal judge told him he got 30 days to do these sorts of things. Well, they took 95 days the first time they had my book, and 45 days the second time, and they wanted to hold it longer. They were trying to block me from putting some of the things out just because some of the things were a little bit embarrassing. And also the fact that a guy named Mike Scheuer wrote a book called Imperial Hubris a year ago, and they really just don't want people writing books anymore, even though 6 previous directors, 20 previous division chiefs, and 100 other officers have already written books.
Was there something about your story that was a little too sensitive?
The thing is I did everything possible to protect sources and methods. I understand what those things are. They just didn't want the story told at this point because they didn't want people to be embarrassed about a few things.
There are lots of spots in this book with black marks, all sorts of things that have been redacted. Was that because they said this is information that shouldn't get out, or was much of that information already published elsewhere and you can't figure out why it's blacked out?
That's exactly right. Some of it, a lot of it, has been written in other places. They just didn't want me confirming it, and had been written, and even some of the things have been confirmed in other agency books that they've cleared. So I thought that was a little bit of hypocrisy there. Look, I care about the agency. I care about the mission. We need to know what works, what doesn't work, so that we can move forward on the war on terrorism to make ourselves safe.
All right.
One of the reasons I wrote the book.
One of the reasons you wrote the book also is because of this hunt for Osama bin Laden, who last week came out with yet another tape. Oh, we're still going to come and attack America. We want to make a truce, all of that nonsense. How frustrating is that for a guy who was on the hunt for Osama bin Laden to hear him still making these proclamations?
Well, the fact that he made the tape again just confirms that he still is out there. I've made the statement when people have asked me, is it important that we get him? And I say to them, leadership matters. I'm a supporter of the president, President Bush, and I think his leadership matters, and leadership matters on the other side, too. And we've got to sort of decapitate that leadership on the other side.
When did your hunt for Osama bin Laden begin? Was it after 2001 or earlier?
Actually, earlier in 1998, of course, I was the chief of our Hezbollah operations unit in the counterterrorism center of CIA. And when the bombings occurred in East Africa, being Nairobi and Dar es Salaam, I was the man that led that deployment, was sent out there. And of course, we thought it was a Hezbollah bombing at the time because they had done many bombings like that. And when we captured the first couple of individuals that were involved in this, we would then learn that bin Laden had gone big. And then, of course, we would start the big hunt at that point.
So you knew about bin Laden before that, but you weren't sure that he was big enough to take care of something like that?
Well, prior to 1998, again, Hezbollah had done the bombings down in Argentina. They had bombed us at Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia. They had done a lot of other catastrophic attacks with car bombs.
Yep.
And so, we were aware of them. We were aware that bin Laden was out there, and it was a unit that was created in CIA that was tracking him and working on this. But again, they had not gone big at that point. And of course, the East Africa bombings were the first major attacks he had conducted on us that were clear, and that he had just previously declared war on us at that point. So we believed him at that point.
Everyone who's read anything or heard anything about our war on terrorism and our attempts to get Osama bin Laden knows the name Tora Bora, the place in the mountains between Afghanistan and Pakistan where he was hiding out. And you guys had him pretty much pinned down to pretty much where he was, but you weren't allowed to go get him. Why was that?
Well, in the middle of November, the capital of Kabul had fallen, and I had received intelligence that he had fled to Nangarhar province in southeastern Afghanistan. I sent an 8-man team in to pursue him. They made contact with a warlord, and you have to remember that we were working with different Afghans at that point. Prior to that, we'd worked with the Northern Alliance, you know, the Tajiks and the Hazara tribes. But now we had to work with Pashtuns. Some of them had been previously, you know, allied with bin Laden. We made a deal with at least one first to start with, and then others later. We would move down. I would get a 4-man team up on a mountain, and we would conduct airstrikes for 56 hours straight against, you know, bin Laden and about 1,000 men that fell back into the mountains with him. So, you know, the U.S. gave us a lot of resources in the way of air power, and I would get more men on the ground, but we wouldn't get the numbers of ground troops that I would ask for.
And so that's the reason we couldn't get them?
That's the reason we didn't get them. Look, when he fell back, there were places there, and there's a chapter in the book, Jawbreaker, where we talk about the Battle of Milliwa. He had armor down there. You know, he had gotten tanks up, and there were some roads that could get into these areas. He had artillery. He had hundreds and hundreds of men with machine guns. I only entered that province with 8 Americans. So we were able to leverage air power to destroy about 75% of his forces, which is a pretty good accomplishment given the small number of Americans that were there, later an SF team and later Delta Force. So, you know, the Americans that were on the ground did remarkable work, you know, in that fight. What we needed was 600 more, and that's what I'd asked for, a battalion of Rangers to be brought in to get between him and the border, because I knew he was going to go for the border.
Who told you no?
Well, you know, the argument was, of course, on the ground with the commander of the Joint Special Operations Command, General Daley, and they wanted to do this with air power. And I didn't believe that the Afghans that we were using to fight with us were reliable enough, nor did they have the desire to close with the enemy as aggressively as needed. You know, they were being used more as a blocking force. So, you know, CENTCOM, of course, made the ultimate decision, and the agency, of course, supported my decision, I'm sure, in making that request. But those were U.S. military forces. CIA didn't have control of those forces. Part of the problem, too, is this was the first time that CIA forces were on the ground doing this sort of thing, probably since World War II, since the times of the OSS. And we were initiating combat operations. We were using insurgent forces in a way that had not been used in many, many years. And I think that that even caught the military by surprise.
Yeah, explain to me how that worked, Gary, because people who are saying, you know, you had these guys and you were going in there. When we think of military action, most of us think of men and women in uniform going and fighting. When we think of the CIA, we think of spies.
Well, you know, in this particular case, we were using case officers, guys that had been spies, you know, in that sense, or operations officers, along with paramilitary officers, CIA officers that had been former members of Delta Force, the SEALs, you know, Rangers, Special Forces. We have a lot of men like this, and men like myself were normal case officers that have had a lot of paramilitary training, and we're on the ground with weapons, you know, with these insurgent forces, fighting side by side with them to go in and to do these things. And then, of course, the U.S. military was blended in with us. This was an unconventional fight. And it was the thing that was needed because, you know, we didn't want to get bogged down there either. We didn't want to have lots of places where they could attack us. We were using small numbers of forces moving around very rapidly, you know, taking the high ground, using lasers to light them up, and it made life miserable for the Taliban and for Al-Qaeda, and they lost thousands of their people.
But the reason, the bottom line that we didn't get him then is because you didn't get the support in terms of troop strength from the Pentagon?
Well, the military wasn't prepared. It happened very, very rapidly. They were unwilling to send in the troops, and which would have required probably significant risk at that point. But my statement was I was able to get my men in and up on those mountains. I thought the military could have done more to get more of, you know, to get conventional forces into that theater.
Got any idea where Osama is now?
Well, I think it's pretty much common. It's commonly accepted that he's all along the Afghan-Pakistani border, living among 25 million Pathans, who, as part of their code of life, will not turn in people, especially other Muslims, who have sought refuge. So, you know, he did a lot of work among those people during the Soviet jihad period of the 1980s. He's got, you know, he did schools and hospitals and development work and helped a lot of people there while he was supporting the fighters inside Afghanistan. So these people are not, you know, likely going to turn him over very easily. And even though there's a big amount of money out on his head, this is still a complicated task.
Talking with Gary Burnson, former CIA field commander. His book is called Jawbreaker, here on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX. What is the status of Afghanistan now? It's been what, 4+ years since you guys went in there? It took 10 weeks to beat the Taliban up and get them out of there. But are they still there, and are they starting to get more control of their own country again?
Well, the Taliban are basing themselves in the northwest frontier province of Pakistan because the central government of Pakistan doesn't have a lot of control. The Pakistanis probably have about 80,000 soldiers in that area, which is not enough to maintain control. So they have a free area to operate in, and they cross the, you know, try to cross into Afghanistan to conduct attacks. And, you know, the U.S. and other allies have forces along that border and are fighting them back and keeping them out. This has been a particularly bad year, the worst year since the war. I think about 1,500 people have died this year. We've had, you know, a number of U.S. casualties, not the number that we're having in Iraq, of course. But, you know, Afghanistan is not something that's going to be fixed, you know, within 10 or 20 years. This is a country in that has tremendous poverty. It's very backward, has problems, you know, lacks in education. But, you know, look, these people have been freed from the Taliban. They did not allow women to work. They did not allow women to study. They wouldn't let women walk around on the streets alone. We have improved the situation there enormously, but it's still a country that has terrible problems. And, you know, opium production is one problem. You know, they've been producing opium there for 1,000 years.
Yeah. If there's one positive thing you could say about the Taliban, and saying this is kind of like talking about Mussolini and the trains running on time, under the Taliban, it was not the poppy capital of the world. Now, unfortunately, it is again.
Yeah, the Taliban did allow some poppy cultivation. They made some money off of that, too. But
oh, did they?
But not as widely. And you are correct in the fact that there has been significant growth in that area.
Let's talk a little bit about pre-war Afghanistan. I mean, and by that, I mean the war that we went to fight there at the end of 2001 after 9/11 and the al-Qaeda connections with Afghanistan and the rest. You mentioned before the Northern Alliance and General Massoud, who was the head of at least part of the Northern Alliance. You had to deal with these people, and at a certain point, I'm guessing you also had to deal with these Afghani warlords to get any sort of coalition together. How does an American make that happen? Do you throw money around?
I had studied Persian. I had been a Farsi speaker in the agency for a number of years. I had been in Afghanistan back in 2000. 15 months before 11 September, I had gone in there to work with Massoud, who was going to help us snatch one of bin Laden's key lieutenants. Had we done that, we might have had warning, on the 11 September attacks. But, you know, the Clinton administration at that point didn't have the stomach for it.
Mm-hmm.
And the director of CIA at that point, Tenet, didn't have the stomach for it.
Mm-hmm.
So they pulled us out. It was very unfortunate. But dealing with these individuals, we had to go in, and of course, we made alliances, and those alliances were based on the provision of cash. We provided them with millions of dollars. So I had lots of money, made payments. Sometimes we'd flip the enemy. Sometimes we'd be on the. We'd find out that an enemy commander would have a satellite phone, and we'd get his number. We'd call him. We'd tell him, look, would you like a deal? Here's what we're going to offer you, this amount of money, or we're going to call in airstrikes on you in the next 12 hours and kill all of you.
Really?
Oh, yes.
And what kind of money are we talking about, Gary?
We're talking about $100,000. I'd say, look, you can get $100,000 if you surrender to me, and I promise you, you'll get, you know, for safe passage back for the duration of the war, and then you'll be able to go back to your homeland, wherever that is, you know, or in Afghanistan, or we can kill you, you know, with airstrikes.
So, I'm sorry to laugh at that, but it sounds so preposterous that we're actually buying off the enemy.
Well, but I'll say this, though. When you're able to bring 1,000 men or, you know, 700 people off the front lines
and
create a huge hole,
yep,
it's a very effective way to do business.
Absolutely. How much money do you think you personally okayed for projects like that?
Millions. In the book, you can see that the team before me passed me, you know, $8 million, you know, and I spent all of that.
The book is called Jawbreaker. Gary Bernson, our former field commander for the CIA in Iraq, with great stories about the attack on bin Laden and al-Qaeda and the Taliban and more. We'll continue as the Paul Harris Show rolls along in just a moment on News Talk 1120 KMOX. Talking with Gary Bernson about his book, Jawbreaker, The Attack on Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, a personal account by the CIA's key field commander. He spent more than 2 decades as an officer in the clandestine service of the CIA, served in an array of field command assignments, has been awarded both the Distinguished Intelligence Medal and the Intelligence Star. Not bad for a guy who almost flunked out of high school, huh, Gary?
Yeah, it's been a long road.
Yeah, you got a lot to be proud of here, and some of these stories are absolutely remarkable. Let me mention a couple of people to you, and you tell me your reaction when you hear their names. George Tenet.
He didn't step up when we needed him in the 90s.
Here's a guy, though, who got the Medal of Freedom from the President of the United States.
Yeah, well, you know, it's unfortunate that it's a very tough thing, because there may have been things that he did that I wasn't aware of, you know, during that point. There are other, you know, for every failure, there's a lot of successes, in the intelligence business. But unfortunately, you know, things weren't done properly in the 90s, and the clandestine service was reduced 25% in size at that point, and we're still struggling under that.
Is that one of the biggest problems we've had with the CIA, that during the decade of the 90s, we started relying too much on technology and not enough on guys like you in the field?
Well, there was and, you know, in the mid-90s, they reduced us, as I said. 25% is huge for a small service. And it wasn't just the interest in relying on technology, it was just a lack of concern for the intel service. You cannot allow your clandestine service to atrophy, and that's what was occurring.
Is that part of the, and we'll get to the other people I want to mention here in just a second, is that part of the problem for the criticism that the CIA got for not having the right intelligence pre-9/11?
Well, you know, when you allow your human collectors to be reduced in numbers, and you don't continually work as hard as you should, when you need them, they won't be there, and the intel wasn't there for the president for Iraq.
I get the feeling, though, reading through some of your chapters, especially on stuff with Al-Qaeda, that we did know stuff, and it just wasn't acted upon. Am I misreading what you've written?
No, you're exactly correct on that. We did know a lot, but there was just a failure to act against them. There was a failure to support, and I guess my biggest beef with Tenet was his failure to support the aggressive action that we needed. He should have told the president, "Mr. President, let us put men on the ground in Afghanistan and end this. I can send teams in. We can find Bin Laden and kill him." And during the late 90s, we could have.
It's always frustrating for anybody in any organization to know that the guy at the top doesn't really know what's going on and doesn't support what needs to be done.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, General Tommy Franks.
Solid general, made one mistake in Tora Bora. You know, he executed a good plan in Afghanistan. He's a fine general. You know, he served his life. He's risked his life for our country. And it's just, you know, I don't think his entire career should be, you know, besmirched because of Afghanistan. But they should have put the troops in and on the ground.
That's the mistake you're referring to.
Yeah.
Not going after Bin Laden at Tora Bora.
With ground troops, with more ground troops.
All right, one more name for you. John Walker Lind. I don't know if you know this, but his dad gave a speech a few days ago where he said he was going to ask President Bush to grant his son clemency. This is the American-born kid from...
Yes, of course I know who he is.
From Northern California, who went off and joined the Taliban. What do you think of him?
He was clearly working with the Taliban. He clearly had an opportunity to help us and help our men inside that prison where Mike Spann died. Spann and another officer gave him an opportunity again and again to talk to us. He could have told us that there was going to be a revolt. He could have tried to help those officers. He could have tried to help himself, but he chose not to. He chose to ally himself with people that wanted to murder Americans. And he is guilty. He should not receive any clemency. And he could have helped our people there, and he didn't. My opinion, he's a traitor.
Got a 20-year sentence for it, although not for being a traitor. He didn't get the potential life sentence there. Right. He ended up pleading guilty to lesser charges of, what was it, supplying services to the Taliban or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did the CIA have enough guys like you who spoke Arabic and Farsi?
There's always been a shortage. There are men and women that speak the language, not enough of them. We need Americans, Muslim Americans, and in the book Jawbreaker, we talk about those Muslim Americans. There were some Muslim Americans that stepped up big time during that war. They're from the Arab world. They're from South Asia. They spoke Arabic. They spoke Pashtun. They spoke Farsi, and they stepped up and they served with distinction. And we should thank them, just like Japanese, German, and Italian Americans in World War II stepped up to serve their country. Muslim Americans are stepping up to serve, but we need more of them, and we need more Americans, you know, who are not of that extraction to, you know, to learn that language, to learn those languages.
Yeah, it's funny because my daughter is now in middle school, and you know, she gets the little pamphlet that says, "Okay, next year when you go into seventh grade, you can take Spanish, you can take French, German." I think there are a total of four languages. Are there any schools in America where kids are learning those languages?
Yes, there are now. And
oh, yeah?
The president just announced a new program nationally to provide additional incentives for the hard languages. And, you know, we're getting a growing population of Middle Easterners here, and we need them to step up to help defend America, and they are. They are. There's some great people in that community in America.
Now, since you spoke those languages and you were there taking al-Qaeda members, and I mean going all the way back to 98 with the incidents in East Africa, when you would take these guys prisoner, who were they? Why had they joined al-Qaeda?
You know, I'll tell you a fascinating story during that. You know, when the individuals were on the parade deck up in the prison in Kalijangi before the revolt, there was a combination of people. They were Chechens. They were from Burma. They were from India. They were some Europeans. There was a mix of people that were there. It was like the United Nations of murderers.
Hmm.
That were on the ground that had all gone there with the express purpose of fighting against America, the Northern Alliance and America. And they stated that to us. It was every murderer in the world thought that this was a good place to go to fight America in a jihad. And, of course, you know, they received their just desserts.
Are these people who had learned to hate America from a very early age?
I think that, you know, when you look around the world right now, if you look at the city of Karachi, for instance, you know, Karachi's got these madrasas, and they have over 200,000 students, talibs, in these schools, and many of them are just given a steady diet of hatred of the U.S.
Yeah.
There is a never-ending stream of people that are being told terrible things about us, things that aren't true.
Right.
You know, that we are anti-Islamic. We're not anti-Islamic. We're against terrorists. Islam is a great religion. It's a great culture. We're not anti-Islamic or anti-Arab, but we're not going to allow people to attack us and conduct a ideology of murder like they are in Iraq.
Yep. Madrasas in Pakistan and in Saudi Arabia and in Egypt and all over that part of the world are a serious problem, and one that I think we need to confront even more than we ever have.
Yes. You're right.
The book is called Jawbreaker, The Attack on Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, a personal account by the CIA's key field commander, Gary Burnson, here on the Paul Harris Show. More coming up. As you read through Gary Burnson's book, Jawbreaker, The Attack on Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, you see lots of things that have been blacked out. Now that the book's been out for a little while, Gary, has the CIA had a chance to go back and reread it and said, okay, you know what, in your next edition you can print that?
Well, we'll have to sit down, and I'm going to have to sit down with them and have a discussion, because there are clearly some points in it that were, you know, look, the CIA briefed Stephen Cole for Ghost Wars, and some of the operations they briefed him on were mine.
Mm-hmm.
They briefed Bob Woodward for Bush at War about some of my operations. They allowed Schroen write about me. So, you know, we go back, you know, I didn't want them to play me out for months and months and months and by doing line by line again and again with them, because they clearly were just stalling and were not negotiating honestly.
Yep.
And so I put out what I had, and we'll go back and have a discussion with them afterwards.
Are the CIA and the FBI playing nice now?
You know, the CIA and the FBI were playing nice together for quite a while. And in the 1990s, you know, I had FBI officers that were in my unit in CIA that were working with us. And anytime anything came up, they could just call the Bureau. And we had CIA officers down in the FBI. We had cross-fertilized. And the relationship was good, and you can see from my story, when I went out to work with them on the bombing, the relationship between CIA and FBI was great on the ground. The relationship, you know, has been good. And, you know, there's a lot overstated regarding animosity. There's a lot more cooperation than you would expect.
Because we hear all these stories about turf wars.
Yeah, it is not that bad. There have been points where things have been missed, but I have to tell you, when things are missed, it's not because people don't want to share it. It's because the volume is so great. We live in a world with 6.5 billion people, and there's a lot of bad things going on in the world, a lot of things to cover simultaneously, and we didn't have enough people in the 90s.
All right, let's talk in the future tense now. What do you see happening with Iran?
We have a problem with Iran. The Iranians, unfortunately, you know, made the decision the last few days to, you know, recontinue or to, you know, jumpstart again with their nuclear program. They're doing that because they perceive the U.S. is exhausted. It's tired from Iraq, and they believe they can get away with it. they're making a mistake, because I think George Bush is you know, regardless of how tired they may think we are, you know, he's going to come after them. He's going to put the pressure on them. I think that the president's doing the right thing by using the international, you know, organizations. He's using the UN. We've got our European allies putting pressure on them. We've got to let this thing run its diplomatic course before, you know, additional options are considered.
What role do the Israelis play in that?
Well, the Iranians have made it clear. The Iranian president stated that he wants to wipe Israel out. He may regret making those statements.
But that's the attitude of the of many people in the Arab world for a long, long time. You know, there's the old line. You've got a country of 5 million surrounded by 50 million who want to wipe them off the face of the earth.
Yeah, you know, people can say that, but when a national leader states that, it looks like it's official government policy, and the Israelis could punish them for that.
Does Osama bin Laden have anything to do with that? Is al-Qaeda a presence in Iran?
Well, you know, there have been reports that the Iranians are holding a number of al-Qaeda members that crossed the border to escape Afghanistan, and they've been holding them at a location there. So, you know, you have to realize that at some point they may just let them go. They may do things with them. It's hard to know, because I'm not reading the intel on those specific things. But that's a factor.
Do you think Iran was involved in 9/11 at all?
No.
No. What about the al-Qaeda? Let's talk about them in the future tense. You know, we had Osama making this tape last week. You were fighting against them for a long, long time. Are they weaker? Are they stronger? What's their status?
I think they are weaker. I think that we've reduced their capabilities. He no longer has a country that he can operate in freely. You know, Afghanistan was like a university system for them. They had, you know, they'd put students in and study electricity here, chemistry there. They'd graduate to improvised explosive devices. They'd teach them how to hijack aircraft. I mean, it was a terrible thing that was going on there. That's closed. He's on the run. He's been reduced, but he's still dangerous because he can still provide inspiration, leadership, and operational planning. I have confidence that we will eventually get him, and the pressure is on him. But we've got to keep up our guard across the board. This thing that we have, this global war on terrorism, really, I don't like the word global war on terrorism. What we have is a struggle against violent extremism, and this is going to go on for the next 2 decades.
Have we learned our lesson, Gary, about intelligence personnel and how important you guys are to the effort?
I'm not sure. I'm hoping that we have learned that. I'm going to write a book on policy, on counterterrorism policy, in the coming months, and, you know, to make recommendations about what we need to do nationally on that. And I think that there's more that can be done. I think we can improve, but the president recognizes that, and you know, and they're making steps to improve. I think that the naming of a DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, and John Negroponte's appointment to such a position was a positive development, that Negroponte can deal with the politics, and that the DCIA, you know, that's the old DCI, now is the Director of Central Intelligence Agency, the new title for him, he can focus on creating or at least maintaining and improving the clandestine service. He can provide leadership instead of managing up.
One last question for you. I know that you resigned from the service last spring and went to work on this book, and put in a lot of distinguished years. Do any of your old buddies ever call you and say, hey, what do we do here? Give me some advice on this, or are they not allowed to anymore?
No, a lot of them have called me to congratulate me on the book.
Well, yeah. I mean about fighting terrorism.
Well, you know, what they've all asked me is when are you coming back into government? I've told them, give me a little time. I'll be back in 2008,
the book,
one way or another.
The book, does that mean you're running for office?
We'll see. I may.
Well, okay. There you go. The book is called Jawbreaker, The Attack on Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, from obviously future presidential candidate Gary Burnson. Thanks for your time today, Gary. I appreciate it.
Been a pleasure.
Great stories in the book and on the air today on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.